Well, if this is Tuesday, the lecture must be on capital. Early in any Austrian series of lectures is special attention to the role of capital, particularly the capital structure, a term that you'll hear often in a number of the lectures this week, which distinguishes, in my view, the Austrian school from many other schools of thought, especially in the field of Austrian macroeconomics. And I'm a macroeconomist, and so that will be my major context this morning, to look at capital in the context of the macro issues. And so I hope to show you that attention to capital, specifically the intertemporal capital structure, constitutes an important difference between the Austrians, let's say, and the Keynesians, and for that matter, between the Austrians and the monetarists, or between the Austrians and any other modern school of thought. The only other school of thought that gives attention of this sort to capital would have to be the Marxist school, which, of course, is different on many other grounds. Sometimes I give a one-word answer to the burning question about what's different about Austrian economics. And my one-word answer is capital. And I hope I can drive that point home during this lecture. I will say that you're getting off easy this week in having only one lecture on the topic of capital. I've been involved in these seminars at the Institute, and then before that, sponsored by the Institute for Humane Studies, then in Menlo Park, California, and now in Fairfax, Virginia. And in some of the early conferences that went on for 2 weeks instead of one, we had multiple lectures on capital and interest, at one point as many as five. Okay, and eventually we realized that we were overdoing it. All right, maybe one, as long as it's early and to the point, will do. You also notice that the topic is capital and not capital and interest, although those two words kind of roll off your tongue pretty easily, and after all, it was the title of Bombeverk's important book. But capital and interest is a term that also is potentially misleading. It almost implies that interest is the price of capital, and that's something that the Austrians would deny. In fact, earlier in this series, yesterday, I believe, you had a lecture on interest, and learned, I think, in that lecture about the dominance of time preference in determining interest rates, whether or not there's any capital involved. Interest is intertemporal terms of trade, whether or not consumable goods are being traded or capital goods or whatever. So interest isn't the price of capital. It's certainly not in the sense that the wage rate is the price of labor or that rent is the price of land. And when we say capital, sometimes symbolizing it with a K, we don't mean financial capital. We mean real capital. We mean plant and equipment, tools and machinery, raw materials, goods in process, and even some things less tangible like skills or human capital and that sort of thing. Real inputs that with time will mature and develop into consumable outputs. That's what is meant by capital, more specifically capital goods, in the Austrian literature. And so the price of capital is simply the price of those things. You know, each one has its price, the price of a machine or the price of a particular quantity of raw materials. That price is not the interest rate, it's the price of the capital good. Since the Austrians deal with capital in all of its complexity, in all the different forms it can take, and in different stages of production related to consumer goods at different time intervals, and that, so it gives full play to an important set of relative prices. What is the price of a long-term capital good compared to the price of a short-term capital good, and how does that price, that relative price, vary with changes in market conditions? How does it respond to changes in consumer preferences or to policy actions on the part of the central bank or the fiscal authority. So these are the kind of questions that can be asked and answered in the Austrian framework. And this is the reason, by the way, that the Austrian macroeconomic theory is much more micro-friendly than the other schools of thought. Students complain about there being a disconnect between micro and macro. They take micro Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. They take macro Tuesday, Thursday. And it's as if there's two different worlds. And one of the reasons, I think, is the lack of attention to relative prices in macroeconomics as conventionally taught. Well, in the Austrian school, those relative prices are there. They're important. They're dominant in the explanation of such things as business cycle, economic growth, and all the rest. This was something that was understood early on by Bohm Bevirk, who, of course, is the author of Capital and Interest that was written in three different volumes from 1884 to 1909. And during that period, not long after the second volume came out, he had an important article in which he discussed the relationship between micro and macro. That was a pretty early discussion of that relationship. If you know anything about the history of economic thought, it's something that hasn't been discussed in the mainstream until about the mid-60s of mid-1960s. So here's what Bohm Bevirk says. He says, one cannot eschew studying the microcosm if one wants to understand properly the macrocosm of a developed economy. If I wanted to translate that into modern terms, it's that macroeconomics needs to have firm microeconomic foundation. And what I've got on the screen is, of course, the translation itself. He originally wrote it in German. I'm sorry, we don't have Guido here to tell us just what that German word was that translated as microcosm. Maybe he'll do it later in the week. But the point is that the Austrians are in on the ground floor in establishing micro foundations for macroeconomics. Right? And that's a topic that was popular in the mainstream in the 1960s and 65 and since. People have worried about micro foundations, and they've searched. I mean, there's a big literature on the search for micro foundations of macroeconomics. And the search hasn't been all that successful, by the way. There have been some stabs at it, but the search has always stopped just short of the Austrian border. Okay, and the idea of actually bringing in relative prices to explain some macroeconomic phenomenon hasn't quite made it into the mainstream in the way that it has in the Austrian school. At this point, I want to give you a little bit of history of thought that will put a few points into historical perspective. And that is that since the Keynesian Revolution, and in fact one important aspect of the Keynesian Revolution, important aspect of Keynes' book, The General Theory, is that capital theory was dropped out totally. There's no capital theory in the general theory. There's worries about markets for capital, and they might fail. In fact, probably will fail, in inherently failure prone. But there's no theory about how they might work in the first place. Okay, there's no theory of capital in the general theory. And this is not something I'm accusing Keynes of, but rather something that Keynes proudly announced in his summing up article that he wrote in 1937, that he congratulated himself for being able to press on with the burning issues of macroeconomics while leaving behind all of those contorted arguments about capital. Okay, and left capital behind and went on with macroeconomics. And so from that point, the Keynesian Revolution, the literature on macroeconomic issues got divided into two totally separate fields. One dealt with short-run problems. That's what we call macro proper. in the profession today that and that has been this way since Keynes. And the long run, which capital does play a role, but a very well-behaved and constrained role. And it goes like this, that in the short run, capital is fixed. Call it K, and if you're into the math, put a bar over the K, K bar. Okay, K bar means it doesn't change, or my own interpretation of the bar, when people put a bar over the K, is don't ask me anything else about capital. Okay, that's K bar. Put that on ice. Okay, not going to talk about that. And we'll deal instead with the economy as it functions with a given capital stock and even a given capital structure, that everything about the capital in the economy is what it is, and it stays that way throughout the analysis of short-run variation in output, income, employment, and all the rest. That's macroeconomics. So the economy in macro can be hideously out of equilibrium and into the depths of a depression or a recession, or it can be overheated, inflation, and all that, but all the while, K is K bar. No change, right? Deal with the disequilibrium instead. Now, in the long run, what happens is it's the disequilibrium that gets put on ice. In other words, the long-run growth models assume an equilibrium growth. And so there are no short-run macro problems while capital changes. And the way capital changes is simply to increase at some rate, and possibly a higher rate or a lower rate or a negative rate or something. But K is no longer K bar, it's K dot. Okay, it changes over time. And the whole analysis is what determines the rate of growth of capital. Those are the growth models, patterned after Robert Solow's early contribution. Solow won the Nobel Prize on the basis of his growth models that allow capital to change but don't allow any disequilibrium. And actually, this has influenced professional advancement in the economics profession in ways that I think aren't thoroughly understood. And it goes like this, that the Austrians sort of fall through the cracks because, as we'll see both in this lecture and in a subsequent lecture I give on business cycles, one of the problems is a capital structure in disequilibrium. Okay, both things at once. Capital is changing, not only in size but in pattern, and it's out of equilibrium. It doesn't reflect people's actual preference. Capital in disequilibrium. That's kind of a tough topic to deal with, both changing capital structure and disequilibrium issues at the same time. But hey, that's what the problem is when you deal with business cycles, depressions and recessions and that sort of thing. And yet articles submitted to mainstream journals have trouble finding a home if that's the topic. And the topic is capital and disequilibrium. In fact, I've had a personal experience with this, where I send an article to a journal. Maybe I send it to a journal that's heavily macroeconomics, and I get a rejection saying that, well, this, the article itself isn't so bad, but it was sent to the wrong journal because it's allowing for changes in the capital stock, and that's really a growth issue, and so this article should be submitted to a journal that deals with economic growth and not macroeconomics. Well, all right, you know, so I repackage it, send it off to a journal that deals with economic growth, and I get another rejection. Now, well, this article isn't so bad in its own right, but it's got disequilibrium going on, and that's really a macro topic. Okay, you send it to the wrong journal. So these two things get separated. And so when you build your career, you make your choice early on. Do you deal with short-run problems of disequilibrium, assuming constant capital, or do you deal with changes in the economy's capital with the assumption of no disequilibrium? You know, that seems to be the choice. And if you try to head right down the middle, you may be very insightful, but you're in trouble professionally. You find no home for your article. Now, this is not a concern that is totally lost on the mainstream. In fact, a few years ago, 1997, there was a special session at the American Economic Association. That's the big one. AEA meets in January, and the big guns come out and man the panels, deal with different issues. And one of the panels was devoted to the question, is there a core of macroeconomics that we can all believe? Which itself is a telling question. You couldn't quite imagine that across the hall there was a similar question about microeconomics. But this was the question about macroeconomics. And drawing from that panel itself and from literature published at in the same year, I can identify two views, and one I call the nagging concern, and the other I call complacency. So, and what I want to point out is that the whole problem is this business of dealing one at a time with these two separate issues and not combining them to see that capital can be in disequilibrium and that can matter. Well, let's look at the two views. I think nagging concern, I won't identify the authors right now, but I'll bring them back later. One major weakness in the core of macroeconomics is the lack of real coupling between the short-run picture and the long-run picture, okay? And then it goes on, since the long run and the short run merge into one another, I don't think I would have quite said it that way, but one feels they cannot be completely independent. Okay, this is sort of a nagging concern. But there's the other view, which I call complacently, and this I picked up on an article by dealing with Trevor Swan. Trevor Swan was one of the early Keynesian interpreters. So his writings serve as a reminder that one can be a Keynesian for the short run and a neoclassical for the long run, and that this combination of commitments might be the right one. Okay, so there's at least some recognition. Now, who do you think wrote it? Let's go back to that one. Who wrote this? Oh, that's Solow. Okay, that's Solow. So that's the guy that did the growth models, but he has a nagging concern that, well, something might be relevant still, even in his growth models, from macroeconomics. Okay, how about this one? Oh, well, that's Solow too. Okay, so these nagging concerns and complacently, they can be in the same individual. It occurs to me this guy might end up being a good economic consultant for the John Kerry campaign. Okay? You got it either way, okay? We see some early warning, even from Maynard Keynes himself, and I think this is telling, because he has prettier prose than Solow, but he's dealing with the same issue. He's critical of those contemporaries of his who dealt only with the long run. And ignored the short run, which of course was his own special focus. And so here's what he wrote as early as 1923, I think. He says, economists set themselves too easy, too useless a task if in tempestuous seasons they can only tell us that when the storm is past, the ocean is flat again. Okay, now you can admire him for the prose. But his whole point is don't be a Ricardian, don't deal just with the long run. You need to deal with the short run too. And even Keynes would say you got to say something about how we get from the short run to the long run. So this is a quote that you see occasionally, but it follows a quote that you see probably the most often quoted sentence from Keynes. Anybody know what it is? There it is. In the long run, we're all dead. So some scholars say that poor old Keynes was taken out of context when he said, in the long run, we're all dead, because what he meant was, if you take this in one interpretation, what he meant was is don't content yourself just with the short-run aspect of it or just with the long-run aspect. You've got to say something about how we get from one to another. I know Murray Rothbard would just cackle over this and say, the problem is Keynes is dead and we're all in the long run, okay, trying to clean up the mess. But so in the long run, we're all dead. Unfortunately, Keynes, as I announced earlier, had jettisoned capital theory. And so he had no micro-friendly way of doing what he was suggesting needed to be done, and so had to resort instead to arguments from psychology, talking about the psychological attitudes and the volatility of psychology in the business community, and drawing analogies to one thing or another. One passage in Keynes, I think, and I say I think because I can't find it. In fact, I'd be eternally grateful for anybody in this room who can find where this comes from. But I've seen it before, and I've heard it attributed to Keynes. That Keynes supposedly was in the waiting area of a seafood restaurant where they had the aquarium. Even back then, I mean, Red Lobster didn't invent the aquarium, you know. The aquarium out front to watch the fish while you wait for your table. And he watched the fish, quite a few small fish in the aquarium, and they'd be all swimming one direction. And then all of a sudden, and before they got to the end of the tank, all of a sudden, and without any particular provocation, they would all change directions and go the other way. And it occurred to him that that's just like the investment community, okay? That's the way investors work. They're optimistic, and they're all going in one direction, and then without any provocation or with no explanation, they all reverse and they're all going the other way. They're all pessimistic, all right? And so he believed that that confidence in the economy was very contagious, and investors were generally optimistic or generally pessimistic, one or the other, and with nothing but psychology possibly to explain how one turned to the other. Which really is a dramatized, you know, to have a theory like that, it just shows what can get sucked into the vacuum after you've dropped the relative price aspects of capital theory out of macroeconomics. Now, Mises did some early warning of his own, telling us to be on guard. And it seems like this is to the point, much more so than some of the others here. We must guard ourselves against the popular fallacy of drawing a sharp line between the short run and the long run effects. What happens in the short run is precisely the first stages of a chain of successive transformations which tend to bring about the long run effects. Right? Now, surely that's it. Okay, that shows how the short run blends in to the long run. And of course, this chain of successive transformations have to do with the movement of capital through the stages of production, the response of the business community to relative prices in shifting resources one way or another in the structure of production, as developed later on by Hayek in Prices and Production. Okay. Now, from this point, I'm going to make a pretty stark comparison between Austrianism, and I've come to call this the sort of search for a term that didn't link the ideas to a particular country. I'm not trying to jettison the term Austrian. In fact, I use it quite a lot in my own writings and in my book, Time and Money. But I also want to put a handle on that theory that anchors it to the ideas on which it's based. And so I call it capital-based macroeconomics, and I'm gratified to see that, and I've been doing this for quite some time, and I'm gratified to see that in the literature now, you're seeing that term, capital-based macroeconomics, used to mean Austrian economics. So capital-based macroeconomics as opposed to labor-based, and Keynesian economics is primordially labor-based, if only because capital has been thrown out of the theory. There's nothing else to base it on. But in other ways, it's labor-based. If you've all taken the intro courses or advanced courses in macro with attention to Keynes, the income to labor is treated as if that's total income, or that total income always moves in lockstep with labor income. So it justifies calling his theory a labor-based theory. I don't think I'd do any damage to his view by using that particular contrast. And I'll show you a number of characteristics of capital-based theory. I say it's a means-ends framework, which might seem to say nothing. Well, of course, what other framework is there? And we'll see in a minute when we look at the what that's contrasted with on the other side of the slide. But a means-ends framework, the employment of means, partly in the form of capital, tools and machinery, plant and equipment, that are aimed at the production of ends, which is the consumable output. So time, the time element, is built into the Austrian theory from the get-go. Right? You have a temporal element in there, and it enters in sort of a two-way manner. And here I draw on lectures that you've already heard in this lecture series, that in one sense, there's a time element going forward. In other words, you have to employ the means before you achieve the ends. Is that right? You employ the means now and in order to achieve the ends at some later time. But coming back in time is the value imputation, the value of the means, whether it's the capital good or the labor that's complementary to the capital. The value of the means is derived from the anticipated value of the ends. So you have a value imputation going one way in time and the actual production process going the other way in time. And they interact. They come into play in ways that are in total eclipse in the more mainstream view. So the means-ends framework is a key characteristic. I use the term structure of production. That's common. You'll see that term used in Hayek, and it's a familiar term. In fact, maybe it's become too familiar that it almost seems to carry its own meaning, but I need to say a few things about it. Ludwig Lachmann, whose best book, in my judgment, is a 1956 book called The Structure of Capital. That's not quite right, is it? Capital and Its Structure. That's the title of Lachmann's book. And he emphasizes that capital structure is an intricate lattice work of capital goods. An intricate lattice work of capital. Well, that probably is a better explanation or a better description of the capital structure, but it's not analytically optimum, I say. We need a concept of a structure of capital that's just short of Lachmann's intricate lattice work, but that tells us more about capital than just calling it K, all right? And so what we typically mean by the structure of capital is the intertemporal structure of capital. In other words, we have stages of production that are lined up from early stage to late stage, and where the output of one stage feeds in as input to the next stage, not to suggest that the actual intricate lattice work is quite that linear. It's not. But at root, there is a strong linear element in it, in that you employ the means before you achieve the ends, and it's done in a succession of stages. And paying attention to that intertemporal structure of capital is what has the most important payoffs, I think, to capital theory, certainly in the context of macroeconomics. And so we go from there to the Hayekian triangle. You'll see one in a minute. I'll show you something about how it works, but you've heard enough about it already to have an idea. The Hayekian triangle is just a graphical representation of that intertemporal capital structure. In other words, it breaks the capital structure down into early stages and late stages. The number of stages is chosen mostly for pedagogical reasons. You could have 5 or 10 or whatever. 5 seems to work because it gives play to all the possible relative price movements that you want to take into account. My own rendition of the Hayekian triangle is one that has time on the horizontal axis going from left to right. That seems like an American thing to do or English thing to do, left to right, time, and so on. And therefore, the vertical leg on the right measures the output of consumable goods, right? It seems like a reasonable way to do it. I have to recognize it's not quite true to Hayek. If you go back to prices and production and look at his triangles, he has time coming down the vertical axis. Well, okay, you could do it that way, but it's a hard sell. Austrian economics is a hard enough sell in the mainstream without trying to have time coming down the vertical axis, okay?
So it goes left to right on the horizontal axis.
One more point. I say stage-specific labor markets. In other words, there's early stages, late stages, middling stages of production, and different kind of things going on at each of those stages, but each stage employing labor of one sort or another that's substitutable. You can transfer workers out of one stage into another, not perfectly so, but you can do it. And so what's important in the Austrian view is what changes in market conditions will cause workers to go from one stage to another, or be fired at one stage, get a job at another, or be bid away by an early stage from a late stage. There you get all sorts of relative price effects, relative wage effects. As different wage rates change, it causes people to work in a different pattern. Right? Again, micro-friendly in picking up ideas that are lost in the mainstream. Let's see. Okay, now what I'll do here is look at what that corresponds to on labor-based economics. And here I'm going to draw my labor-based economics, my Keynesian theory, from the textbooks, from the elementary textbooks or even the intermediate textbooks. So I'm not taking a shot here at some of the highly mathematical micro-modeling that goes on at University of Minnesota or University of Chicago or whatever. I'm just looking at what gets presented to students in classrooms all over the country and universities of all sorts. Instead of a means-ends framework,
we have an income-expenditure framework. And you've seen this if you've taken the intro class. I have a whole section of lectures in my intro class that's called Earning Money and Spending It. Okay, and it's the income-expenditure model. It's not means-ends at all. The income and the expenditures both occur in the same period. Right? You pick a period, the current period, so much is earned, so much is spent, and then the next period, something else like that, similar, happens again. But there's no time that comes into play in any meaningful sense here. It's all current period stuff.
Instead of a structure of production, you have structural fixity. And here I go back clear to the general theory and point out that one of Keynes' early chapters, chapter 4, the title is Choice of Units, very innocuous-sounding chapter. It's almost a throat-clearing chapter where Keynes is deciding about the particular units, the particular terms he's going to use. But he throws in some assumptions that never get relaxed throughout the whole book. And one of them is structural fixity. And his own term, he calls it a fixed structure of industry. I assume that the structure of industry remains fixed. And, of course, he's thinking more in terms of labor. So he says the same pattern of skills, the same ratio of skilled to unskilled labor, the same relative proportions of labor hired in the steel industry as opposed to the energy industry and so on. Okay, so everything is fixed because this translates readily into a fixed structure of production, which in my view just sort of gives the whole ballgame away right there. Once he's assumed that's fixed, then he's very limited in just what he can say about how the economy actually operates. Instead of a Hayekian triangle, you have the circular flow. In fact, that's the thing you've seen the drawings of firms and industries and firms working or individuals working for the firms and buying goods from the firms. That's the way you depict that income expenditure framework, just like Hayekian triangle is the way you depict the means-ends framework. So if you're looking for sort of a iconic representation of the differences between the Austrians and the mainstream, or the Austrians and the Keynesian, there it is. It's one's a triangle and the other's a circle. Okay. Hayekian triangle, the means ends. And circular flow in the case of Keynes. And when I get a new issue of one of the mainstream journals and I see some macro theory laid out, however complex it is, it's pretty easy to boil it down and look to see what's going on, to see if it's based on some circular flow basis or something else, and identify it as being Keynesian or not Keynesian on that ground. And then instead of stage-specific labor markets, Keynes works with the labor market. Okay, you just have a supply and demand of labor per se. And so there's no relative wage rates that can cause workers to change in the pattern. And in fact, no scope for change anyhow, because you've already assumed structural fixity. And so the only issue becomes, is that wage rate flexible, or is it sticky? Is it sticky downward or sticky upward too? Or is it stuck? You know, that becomes the Keynesian issues. Okay, now to push further, what I want to introduce is is a methodological maxim that I think is critical to getting macro straight. It's critical to get a lot of things straight in other fields of economics too. And it's a maxim that gets overlooked in the mainstream, but one that just commands assent just by stating it, I think. At least in my judgment it does. So let's take a look. Call it Hayek's maxim. I paraphrase Hayek from something he wrote in 1948. And he says, before we can explain how the market process can go wrong, we must first explain how it could ever go right. Right? Well, doesn't that seem reasonable? You have to have some idea of how it could go right before you take a crack at explaining what might go wrong. Right? And yet this maxim is observed in the breach, as they say, more often than not. In fact, it's flouted outside the Austrian school fairly routinely. And in fact, much of Hayek's work, much of the Austrians' work, just applies to Rothbard too, in setting out macro problems, business cycles and so on. You have to make two stabs at it. The first stab is just showing how the market can work, what can happen, how it can go right, and then going through again and showing what can go wrong. Right? And that first part, though, gets skipped by the Keynesians. That's reflected, by the way, in the course offerings in universities all over the country. Many have changed now, including Auburn, I'm happy to announce. But when I first came to Auburn, long, long ago, we taught our principal sequence macro first, and then micro. And that was typical of universities all over the country. Textbooks were written that way. Some of the early editions of Samuelson were written that way. And in fact, the macro first, all the things that can go wrong in the economy, were thought to be so important. It was called the New Economics of Keynes. So important that if students were only to take one course in economics, that should be it. Okay. So everybody takes macro first to find out all the things that can go wrong in the economy. All right? And then if those of them who aren't just totally turned off by that course, if they sign up for another, they take micro and figure out how it might have worked in the first place. Okay. Well, it seems to make sense to teach the micro first. Okay. You teach the micro first, explain how markets can actually work, and then come back and explain how certain things can go wrong. But you see, Keynes flouted this maxim simply because he didn't think markets could ever work right. Okay? He wasn't going to spend any time explaining how they could work right. He didn't think they could. He thought the market was inherently flawed such that it couldn't possibly work right. And he didn't spend any of his time
trying to explain that. Okay, that was just an operating assumption. And the question is, what all goes wrong and how to fix it by extra market forces. And to demonstrate that, flouting the maxim, this is Keynes. This is from the general theory. And look what he says, very strong statement. He says, every attempt to save more by reducing consumption, well, how else would you save more? But save more by reducing consumption will so affect incomes that the attempt necessarily defeats itself. Okay, that's very strong. Okay, you got two words in there, every and necessarily. So it's not possible, in Keynes' view, for the economy to work right. You'll recognize this as Keynes' paradox of thrift. If people save, trying to save up for something and do better for themselves in the future, paradoxically, it doesn't work. It just causes the economy to go into a recession in the present, right? So every such attempt necessarily fails. The economy never works right. So they don't need to spend any time explaining how it could work right. It never does, right? A year or so ago, I had some correspondence with David Laidler, who is sort of an Austrian-friendly monetarist, and writes some pretty good economics. And I think I've got later in this show his own account of the Austrians, which isn't bad. It's pretty good stuff. But in the correspondence I had with Laidler, I suggested that Keynes had flouted the Hayek maxim, and was interested to see what Laidler would say about it. And he wrote back, and he said, well, Keynes is in good company. Everybody flouted the Hayek maxim. No, nobody thought the economy could work right, so he didn't spend any time on it. Okay, now you've seen the phrase descriptions. Let's look at analytics. There's a Hayekian triangle. And I want to spend a little, you've seen the thing before, but I want to spend a little time just explaining what it's about. And I can pick up on a lecture that Peter Klein gave yesterday, where he made the point of a theory of production on the one hand and a theory of the firm on the other hand, explaining how firms operate. In the theory of production, we can divide the production process into a number of temporal stages. And here, just as a point of illustration, just sort of a concrete hit-you-in-the-face description of the kinds of things that are at the different stages. I've got, you can't read it from the back or maybe the front even, mining, refining, manufacturing, distributing, retailing. These are things that all go on in the economy in a sequence so that the output of the mine sells as input to the refining process, and the output of the refining process sells as input to the manufacturing process, and so on. This is a fact that's not lost even on the mainstream. In fact, if you read your mainstream intro text, you'll see a similar illustration, usually in terms of wheat and bread and bakery and, you know, that kind of stuff, where the only point is we have to be careful not to double count when we add it all up. And when we calculate gross national product, we want to make sure we don't add the value of the wheat to the value of the dough to the value of the bread to the, you know, if you do that, you've double counted, right? So can't do that. You have to add value added along the way, or just count the final output. Well, the Austrians are here to say, yeah, and you also got to keep track of the time too. You got to keep track of the time that these things happen at different points in time, and time matters and so on. But of course, that gets lost on the mainstream. They don't do that. So anyhow, these stages, the individual stages, don't mean individual firms. A single firm may work in several stages, depending on what the firm's doing. An example I use in my book is a paper mill, a firm that produces paper. What stage of production is it in?
Well, it depends on what's happening to the paper. If it's selling paper to a blueprinter, paper for blueprints, well, the production of the paper is an earlier stage even to the blueprints, which is early to the building a building, which is, you know, it's early stage stuff. On the other hand, if it's selling paper to Hallmark for greeting cards, it's pretty late stage stuff, isn't it? So it's a particular production going on and not the fact that the firm itself is an early stage or late stage firm. And at the same time, other firms might operate simultaneously in several stages. If a firm is in the energy business, it's possible that it's extracting oil. It might be exploring for oil and drilling for oil and extracting oil, refining oil, distributing it, and selling it at gas stations. It's in a lot of different stages of production. And even when it sells it at the gas station, if it's selling it to 18-wheelers, they're in the early stage, too. It's not exactly a consumption good there. So there's a lot of there is this intricate lattice work, but nonetheless, we're focusing on the essential time element that underlies it all. Some of the critics of Austrian capital theory jettison the whole idea of an intertemporal structure on the grounds that there are feedbacks or little eddies of some kind. That Frank Knight argued that, well, okay, coal is used to produce steel and steel is used to produce coal, so where do you put them in the triangle? And of course, you could come up with countless examples of that sort. Still, at root, there's a time element and a justification, I think, for dealing with the stages of production. It's important, I think, to see that this triangle, simple as it is subject to two different interpretations, both of which come into play in sorting out the theory. And here you'll see, and you'll, if not now, you'll see later, that I'm sort of setting myself up for a later lecture on business cycle theory. But if you look at the triangle, you can see it as a process in time. You can see things actually happening, starting to the left and moving to the right in ways that I've described it just a few minutes ago about mining, refining, and so on. On the other hand, you can see it as a structure of industry that exists at a given point in time. So that in this short week-long course, if we had time for field trips, we could load you up in a bus and take you around and see mining operations and manufacturing and distributing. We could show you yanking steel out of the ground. I mean, there's steel mills in Birmingham, you know. You yank steel out of the ground and then take you to an automobile showroom and say and see new automobiles with steel in them right now, today, on the same day. Okay, here's steel coming out of the ground. Here's steel in the new automobile, both today. So these things all go on at the same point in time, and yet the steel that's coming out of the ground today, of course, won't show up in the automobile showroom until some months or years in the future. There's still that time element. Frank Knight, again, rejected the Austrian capital theory precisely on the grounds that it's all simultaneous. That, you know, just go out and look. You can see that the stuff coming out of the ground is the same stuff that's already in the fenders of the automobile. So it all happens today. It's as if it all happened today. So we can ignore the time element according to Knight. I don't believe it. I think that you have to take that time element into account. But I also point out that it all goes on today in order to allow myself to argue later that it's possible to shift resources from late stages to early stages. Okay, we can, people that are working here in retailing can be bid away to refining without involving any kind of time travel, right? This, I'm countering here objections that I've gotten from some of my sophomores at Auburn. I probably shouldn't mention this, but it doesn't involve time travel, right? You can move from one stage to another and still maintain the integrity of the triangle. Now, in the analytics, even see, I've got it divided about five stages. That allows for relative price effects. Some go up, some go down. Maybe one in the middle stays the same, and the two at either ends go up or down at different rates. I mean, you get all of the kind of variation there. But in actually putting the theory through its paces, we can just make do with the triangle itself, so just clean it up, right? And what's important about this intertemporal structure is the fact that it can change not just in size, but in shape. That's the key. It can change. This thing can change in shape. Resources can be reallocated from early stages to late stages, or from late stages to early stages, in response to changes in market conditions. Right? And here's where the interest rate does come into play in an important way. Not that it's the price of capital, but it's the key market signal that allocates capital within the structure of production. Right? Now, let me give you a hypothetical example, and we'll change the triangle to accordingly. Suppose that people become more future-oriented. They decide to save more. And in my class, I've learned not just to use the letter S for savings. I use the four letters S, U, F, S, which stands for save up for something. Okay. In other words, when people save, they're saving up for something. Even they might not know just what yet, but they're saving up for something. They're not saving just for fun. It's not fun. Right? It's not fun. They're saving up for something. And you think we would have to say this, but in Keynesian economics, saving is just a residual. It's what's left over after you've got through consuming, and it has no particular significance beyond that. But they're saving up for something. And so what that suggests is that the pattern of consumption that they want is a relatively lower pattern now in order to have a relatively higher pattern in the future. Right? Now here we get to the question of what can go right. How does the market need to work? What would have to happen for the structure of production to be changed in such a way to accommodate that change in saving? You want a production process that doesn't produce quite so much now, but that will produce more for the future. How do you do that? Well, you take resources and you take them away from the late stages of production and add them to the early stages, and maybe create earlier stages still. All right? The triangle needs to change in that way. And let's watch it change just as a, it's just a miracle here. It's going to change just the right way. Okay? So it changes in shape. In that way, you have more long-term production and less production in the immediate future. Now, it's not really a mystery of a change. It changes precisely because when people save more, they made loanable funds more available. They bid down the price of loanable funds. Hey, that's the interest rate. The interest rate is lower. And when the interest rate is lower, long-term projects are favored. Okay? Interest costs are more dominant in long-term projects than in short-term projects, so they have a competitive edge. And firms tend to engage in longer-term production in response to a lower rate of interest. Okay, that's a matter of basic finance. We could also see that workers who are working at the different stages find that jobs are harder to get in the late stage and they're easier to get in the early stage. So labor is working for early stage operations instead of late stage. And the consequence of all that is precisely to shift the availability of consumption goods into the more distant future, which is consistent with the initiating change of increased savings. People are saving up for something, and something is going to be ready for them at the time that they're prepared to spend those saved up funds. Okay? Now, all this gets denied by Keynes in the Paradox of Thrift, and I'll show you that shortly as well. In fact, at this point, let's see. I'll bring in the circular flow, and I'll give this short shrift because I'm running short of time, but we can make it. The circular flow is something that's just common to all textbook presentations. It's still there. It's in the principles text. It's in the intermediate text. And in some of the less guarded principles texts, it's used now just like it was 30 or 40 years ago. Something like this. You can see how it works. You have firms and individuals. Firms earn an income from the, or individuals earn an income from the firm. They spend the money on output of the firm. So you have a two-way circle, income and expenditures going one way, labor and goods going the other. This is labor-based economics. There's no capital involved. And it's used in some of the textbooks, at least, and implicitly in all of them, to explain such questions as, why were times so good in the 20s? And why were times so bad in the 30s? Okay. Can you explain that? If you're given an essay test in a mainstream principles course, can you explain it? Well, of course you can. You say, in the 20s, why were times so good? Well, because everybody had a job. Well, fine. But how was that? Well, firms were willing to hire anybody who wanted to work. They were? Yeah, they wanted to produce all they could. Well, why were they producing? Well, they had no problem selling it. Why didn't they have problems? Everybody was buying. They had plenty of money. How was that so? They all had jobs. Okay, I think I get it. But why were times so bad in the 30s? You know the answer? Nobody had a job. I'll let you tell the rest of the story. You know how it works out. You go around in a circle. Okay? And I challenge my students to go up in the economics department knocking on Keynesian doors and asking, you know, does this seem a little circular? But some of my Keynesian friends, when asked this question, does this seem a little circular? You know, they say, yes, that's it. That's the beauty of it. It explains the circular flow in the economy. The economy is circular. You know, don't you get it? So the problem then comes when, I mean, what kind of a problem could you have with a circular flow? How do you get from the 20s to the 30s? Well, it has to be some break in this circular flow that people that were spending money somehow quit. Why? Well, psychology takes over. They become, they have less confidence. They don't spend as much. And so let's look at it here. So you have income equal expenditures. Expenditures equal income. You got it there. Suppose they don't spend as much. And watch the E. I think that's what, yeah, okay, a little bit of E. They're not spending as much. Now what? Well, they're still earning as much because they're still producing as much. They're not spending as much. They're not buying the stuff. It's piling up at the level of the firm. It's called excess inventories. Microeconomists just call it surplus. They expect prices to change. But macroeconomists say it's excess inventories. I don't know if we can get the excess inventories into the picture. We'll see. Yeah, there they are. Okay. Excess inventories that piles up at the firm. And, of course, if that piles up at the firm, then employers start laying off people, cutting back, and so on, and income goes down. There it goes, okay? So now we've gotten from the 20s to the 30s, just on the basis of a loss in confidence and a spiraling down of the income and expenditure. And my view is a wholly inadequate explanation. I think what I want to do now, and I'll do it very quickly, we'll go back to the 20s, you see. I'll put in my Hayekian triangle. And what I'll show now is what a Keynesian process like that looks like from an Austrian point of view. So you have an income-expenditure relationship there with a fixed capital structure. Right? So it means that triangle is not going to change in shape. It can only change in size. Right? So now, watch again. We have to watch them both at once. There. See, so you go down lower income, lower expenditures, and implicitly, lower activities at each and every stage of production. That's what happens when you omit capital theory from macroeconomics. If we turn this around and let Keynes track what's going on in the Austrian view, then what you see is in the Austrian view, you can get the change in shape without any first order change in the actual volume of income and expenditures. And so we have a change like that where, you have less income being earned in the late stages, more in the early stages, but total income earned isn't
a whole lot different from what was before. So you maintain the full employment of the circular flow. Okay. I have a few slides here on hinting at an Austrian comeback, but I think I'm going to skip over those and end the lecture here and take a couple of minutes of questions. Thank you.